Let's get started then right now with lesson 165, the work in progress documents analyzing the pre-1611 evidence for the text, part four. Okay? So this is part four of looking at what is the evidence, historical evidence that we know of. The technical word is extant. Extant means in existence and available. There's probably more things that are yet going to be discovered, is my personal belief, in these different libraries and so forth in England. It's just sort of a slow process, right? In the last, well, longer than I've been alive, let's say 60 years, there's been, it seems like, a number of different discoveries that have been made, and every time a new discovery is presented to the public, it definitely presents a little bit more detail in our understanding of what happened with the King James Bible between 1604 and 1611. This is the fourth study that we're doing and looking at these work in progress documents. And like I've tried to communicate to you the last couple weeks, by the way, my voice is better than last week. I'm hoping it holds up, so we'll just sort of have to see how that goes. I did not make a midweek video this week just because I wasn't able to talk very well. The majority of the week, really. It's only been the last couple days where I felt like I had some stamina in my voice. But anyway, so 2 weeks ago I talked to you about how literally I've been learning new things that I didn't know at the beginning of the year all through this month, and this has led to me adding some lessons to what we're doing that I did not originally intend on doing. Specifically last week, part three, where we looked at the manuscript Ward B, the work of Samuel Ward on the apocryphal section in Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge. We looked at that last time, and then what we're going to be talking about today with the correspondence of John Boyce and Isaac Casaubon. Is that how we're saying this, Mike?
Yeah.
All right. So we have the official ruling, so we'll move on. Anyway, so let's get right into the introduction. In lesson 164, we began looking at additional work-in-progress primary source documents that have come to light in the last decade, literally from 2015 until now. So we're talking in the last 7 years, give or take. Some more things have been uncovered. Okay. Specifically, what are we talking about? We're talking here about manuscript Ward B from Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge. We talked about that last week in lesson 164. We're also talking about a Greek Old Testament possessing the handwritten notes of John Boyce. There's a story about that. I had a picture of it last week. And then three unpublished letters between Frenchman Isaac Casaubon and John Boyce. Those are in the British Library. And then correspondence between Casaubon and translator Andrew Downs. So those four items have been recent discoveries in the last 7 years, the latter half of the last decade. These findings were made public and published pieces between 2015 and 2018. In the case of manuscript Ward B, Jeffrey Allen Miller discussed this document in his October 16, 2015 piece for the Literary Times Supplement, or Times Literary Supplement, titled Fruit of Good Labors, the Earliest Known Draft of the King James Bible. In the possession of Sydney Sussex College at Cambridge, manuscript Ward B contains the individual first draft work of Samuel Ward, a member of the second Cambridge company that worked on the Apocrypha. A second, longer essay titled, The Earliest Known Draft of the King James Bible, Samuel Ward's Draft of 1st Esdras and Wisdom 3 through 4, was written by Miller in 2018 for a compilation of essays on the King James Bible titled, Labor is in the Vineyard of the Lord, Erudition in the Making of the King James Version of the Bible. Miller's essay serves as chapter 7 of this volume. So that was the essay that we covered last week. Okay, The Ward manuscript brings our total of primary work in progress documents to 4. As it stands right now, the list includes, number 1, manuscript Ward B, the first draft work of Samuel Ward on 1st Esdras and Wisdom 3-4 of the Apocrypha. Manuscript 98, stage 1 work of the 2nd Westminster Company on the New Testament Epistles, Romans through Jude. Bob 1602, an annotated 1602 Bishop's Bible, containing the revisions of the King James translators for portions of the Old and New Testaments. The stage of the work represented by the annotations in about 1602 varies by section. We'll talk more about that later. And then the notes of John Boyce were taken at the general meeting at Stationers Hall during the final stage of the process. So we've looked at all of those, okay, so far, at least in a preliminary way. A second series of findings by Dr. Nicholas Hardy of the University of Birmingham was announced on the university website on the 30th of April, 2018. In an article titled, New Sources Prove a Frenchman was one of the translators of the King James Bible. So those will be links, by the way, when these notes are made live online. Well, there are already links. You can see here. So if we click on that link, it will take us, or it should take us, to the write-up on the Birmingham University website of Dr. Hardy. And then we can also go to this piece right here from April. This is on the university webpage as well. And there again is the picture of the Old Testament, the Greek Old Testament that John Boyce is annotating. Okay, let's go back to page two. The second series of findings by Dr. Nicholas Hardy of the University of Birmingham was announced on the university website on the 30th of April, 2018. Now, if my memory's correct, that's this article right here. So this is the article that's posted to the university webpage on the 30th of April, 2018, announcing to the public these items that Dr. Hardy has identified in these various libraries, okay? It was Dr. Hardy who uncovered the Greek Old Testament containing the handwritten notes of John Boyce, unpublished letters between Frenchman Isaac Casaubon and John Boyce, and correspondence between Casaubon and translator Andrew Downs. So that's this picture. And you can see, if we just scroll down on this, they identify what these things are. And there's also a short video made explaining this. If anybody would want to watch any of these things, they can go through here and look at what the university is announcing here. Okay. As I stated in Lesson 164, while these discoveries are amazing finds, they are not necessarily all work-in-progress documents that speak directly to the translation process utilized by the translators. Therefore, we will limit our comments in this class to manuscript Ward B, which we did already, and the correspondence between John Boyce and Isaac Casaubon. That said, the existence of the annotated Greek edition of the Greek Old Testament by Boyce and the notebook of Casaubon recording his correspondence with Andrew Downs need to be noted. Further study of these documents could shed more light on the translation process in the future. The rest of this lesson will be devoted to a discussion of the letters between Boyce and Casaubon. Now, if you guys just flip quickly back in your notes, go to the end, and if you go all the way to the end of page 10, you can see that I've included in an appendix some material regarding this Greek Old Testament with the notes of Boyce. All right, I did not include this in the body of the lesson, but I did think it was important enough to note it and capture it in the printed notes of this lesson. And so it is here both on the website and in your notes. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about it in the main part of the lesson. So it definitely is something, if you're into this, that is worth reading on your own time and checking out. Okay? Any questions about any of that? So go back to page two. So, let me see if I can also get here. Let's see here. All right. So the Boyce-Casaubon correspondence. To date, the most complete treatment of the correspondence between Boyce and Casaubon is found in Dr. Nicholas Hardy's essay, Revising the King James Apocrypha, John Boyce, Isaac Casaubon, and the Case of First Esdras. Dr. Hardy's essay comprises Chapter 8 of Laborers in the Vineyard of the Lord, Erudition and the Making of the King James Version of the Bible. The correspondence between Boyce and Casaubon can be found in Manuscript Burney 363 in the British Library. Okay? Now, I have paid money to access this essay. Here's my copy of it. This is Chapter 8, We looked last week at chapter 7, which was about manuscript Ward B. Chapter 8 of this book, Laborers in the Vineyard of the Lord, is covering Hardy's discoveries here on the Casaubon and Boyce correspondence, which we're going to be looking at today. So, I'm under some restrictions regarding copyrights, et cetera, and having faith for these chapters. And so, I will quote them in the notes and give credit, but I cannot make the full essays public at this time because of, you know, those types of considerations. So, let's get right into it. So, first thing we want to talk about is who is Isaac Casaubon? All right, why is a Frenchman who speaks little English having anything to do with the King James Bible, arguably the most influential piece of English literature in history? Why and how is this Frenchman contributing to this, and why would Boyce and others reach out to him? So the first thing we kind of want to look at then is who is Isaac Casaubon? Dr. Hardy answers this question in the opening paragraph of his essay, quote, "When the Huguenot scholar Isaac Casaubon left Paris for England in October 1610, he hoped to fulfill several ambitions. One was to protect himself and eventually the rest of his large family from a new wave of religious violence that he feared might break out over France after the assassination of his patron and the author of the Edict of Nantes, King Henry IV. Now let's just stop there. He's a Huguenot, which means he's a French Calvinist. That's who Casaubon is. He is a reformer. He's a Huguenot. He's a French Calvinist. The Edict of Nantes was a piece of legislation that was drafted in France to create religious tolerance between Catholics and Huguenots, or Catholics and Calvinists within France. All right. So his patron, the king here, King Henry IV, was assassinated. And Casaubon is afraid that this is going to lead to an outbreak again of religious persecution in France between Catholics and the Huguenots, etc. Okay? So he is going to flee France to England in October 1610, and those are the circumstances that lead to him fleeing France and going to England. Look at the next sentence. Another ambition not connected to the first was to write more freely on the subject of religion, and especially the early history of the church, than he had been able to in his Catholic homeland. Casaubon's third ambition was to continue to work on classical as well as Judeo-Christian literature and history that had made him the most widely acclaimed living humanist. So he's a humanist in the classical sense of humanist of the Renaissance. All right, he is studying the ancient Greek and Roman literature, the poets, etc. He is embracing the mindset of the Renaissance of looking at the ancient authors, not limiting yourself to Latin. And so when you see there that he's a humanist, this does not mean humanist in the modern sense of the word. Today in the 21st century, if we call somebody a humanist, we are referring to them as probably an atheistic materialist. That's what the word means now. That's not what it was back in the early 17th century when he flees France to come to England. Okay, now I've talked about that a lot in other studies. The idea of a humanist during the Renaissance being different from the idea of a humanist today. So if I remember, I'll try to put some links in the description under this video for that. But I don't want to spend a bunch of time going over all of that again. Just understand that he is a French Calvinist. So he is sympathetic to the aims and so forth of the Reformation. And he is also embracing the idea of humanist tradition of the day of studying things in their original languages and then translating them into the vernacular languages of the people. Okay. So, next point. That Casaubon would contribute to the King James Bible, arguably the pinnacle of written English, seems unlikely given the Frenchman knew little, if any, English. Quote, "In one respect, Casaubon was an unsuitable candidate to advise on the English translation of the Bible. He barely understood the target language. Casaubon had been asked for advice about vernacular translations of the Bible before, but only in languages which he could read. Casaubon spent nearly 4 years in England before his death in July 1614, and his efforts to learn English are witnessed by an annotated copy of Francis Bacon's Advancement in Learning. The book is marked up with accents to indicate where stress was to be placed in pronouncing words, and marginal glosses translating unfamiliar terms into French, Latin, or Greek, but Casaubon apparently never achieved fluency in the language. He spent much of his time in England at James's court, yet he struggled to follow vernacular sermons, which he heard there, as is commented on in his diary from the 2nd of January, 1611. So, let's just understand. He never, it seems, that he never really gets English totally before he dies in 1614. So he's here for roughly 4 years, here, by here I mean in England, for roughly 4 years before he dies in 1614. He had a copy in his library of Francis Bacon where he had, you know, done like they do in the dictionary where they put the different markings on trying to help you pronounce a word. He had gone through this book and added those markings to it and then added translations of some of the words to the margins. So, and he notes in a diary on the 2nd of January 1611, Casaubon's limitations in English did not disqualify him from participating in discussions pertaining to the English Bible. Fluency in Latin, the scholarly language of his day, granted Casaubon access to debates. Quote, "This did not, however, disqualify Casaubon from participating in debates about the English Bible. On the same day that Casaubon sat through this largely incomprehensible sermon," so that's the 2nd of January, 1611, "the king and his bishops must have switched to Latin for a task that provided one of Casaubon's first tastes of their preoccupation with biblical translation and scholarship. Casaubon records that after the sermon," so this is the sermon from the 2nd of January, 1611, in English that he didn't understand very well, okay? He's recording in his diary that after the sermon, the king spent, now think about this, what we're about to read, spent a long lunchtime examining the notes that accompanied the Catholic translation of the Latin Old Testament and the Apocrypha, recently published at Douay, as a follow-up to the translation of the Reims New Testament of 1582. So after church, King James retires to a lunch. And at the lunch, they're debating and discussing the Douay Old Testament at lunch with the king. That's crazy. The king is reading this, and he's fluent in all this, and he's just talking to these guys about it. It shows you again the level of religious education and interest that James had in these things. Remember, we've talked about this before, right? So let's read the next sentence. Let's see. James Montag, Bishop of Bath and Wells, read the notes. The king gave his presumably not very positive judgment on them, and Casaubon, along with Lancelot Andrews and Richard Nelly, Bishop of Lichfield and Coventry, I guess.
Coventry.
What?
Coventry.
Indicated their approval of what the king had said. Casaubon was impressed to find James so studious in such matters compared with his former patron, Henry IV. So, the conversation switches to Latin. So imagine the king, this French scholar, Casaubon, Lancelot Andrews, and this other guy, Richard Nelly, and James Montag, five guys sitting around listening to the Douay Old Testament being read and some of the notes being read and discussing it in Latin. As soon as they start talking about it in Latin, is Casaubon able to participate in the conversation? You guys following this? Okay? I don't know. That just blows my mind that the king is sitting there at lunch talking about things in Latin. It does show that James is really concerned and interested in these, in this whole conversation of the Bible. So, you know, James, it's interesting. James certainly was no friend of the Puritans, but neither was he any friend of the Catholics. Yeah.
Was the Latin spoken at that time, or was it just a written?
Oh, no, it was spoken.
Oh, was? Okay.
It was spoken and written.
Okay.
Yep. They could have easily just had a conversation in Latin the way we are right now. In fact, when you read Boyce's notes, his notes go back and forth between Greek, Latin, and English, like it's you know, as easy as taking a sip of your coffee. That's the level of depth they had in these things. Okay. So let's look at the date, circumstances, and contents then of the Boyce Kasuban correspondence. Dr. Hardy reports the following regarding the date and circumstances of the letters between Boyce and Kasuban. Quote, we need a quotation mark there at the beginning. At some point after Kasuban arrived in London, Boyce wrote to Kasuban about, quote, a few specific passages which were somewhat obscure. Boyce and his company had struggled with them while they were translating the Apocrypha. Two letters from Boyce and a reply from Kasuban survive among the collection of manuscript letters addressed to Kasuban in the British Library. These letters discuss some of these problems in great detail, and they give us a glimpse of what must have been a more extended series of exchanges about the translation that took place through conversation as well as correspondence. So we only are able to know what they discussed in the portions of this that they actually wrote down. There's a strong evidence in what they wrote down to suggest that they probably talked in person. Okay? Let's go on. The Boyce Kasuban correspondence presents a tremendous opportunity. More than any other source, it can be used to reveal the intellectual depth of some of the translators' efforts. They drew on the work of continental figures whose views, methods, and intellectual legacies are not well known among scholars of vernacular Bible translations. The role of Kasuban himself illustrates this most vividly, but he is far from the only non-English scholar whose work was an important reference point. The translators' frequent resources to the whole gamut of contemporary biblical scholarship, which was necessitated by the range of theological, historical, and theological problems which they were trying to address. This went far beyond simple choices of wording or phrasing and extended to the authorship and dating of 1st Esdras, the reliability of different textual witnesses too, its value as a sidelight on the sections of the canonical Old Testament with which it overlapped, and the cultural context in which it was written, including its relationship to pagan as well as Jewish texts. In considering these issues, the translators were employing historical and critical techniques of interpretation whose prominence in early modern theology and biblical scholarship has been aptly demonstrated by intellectual historians, even if scholars of vernacular translations may not yet have given them much attention. So, let's just stop there. What he's saying there is that the nature of the conversation between these two guys about what is going on in some of these passages in the Apocrypha demonstrates an awareness of a massive swath of information from a bunch of different categories, including history, theology, and philological, which is related to the history and usage of words. Okay? The content of the letters makes it clear that at the time of writing, Boyce was involved in the final stages of revision of the King James Bible. Now let's just stop there. We already know that because we know about his notes on the process taken at Stationer's Hall. Right? So the correspondence between Kasuban and Boyce is dating from very late in the revision process of the King James Bible. And I'll show you how we know that. Given the challenges which scholars have previously faced in tracking the progress of that revision, and especially in establishing how long it might have continued into 1611, it is worth trying to date them more precisely. The terminus post quem, or earliest possible date, I'm just going to read the English, okay, for this correspondence must be October 31st, 1610. So, the earliest possible date would be October what?
1610.
That would be the earliest possible date for these letters. Here's why. Okay? Let me start over. The earliest possible date for this correspondence must be October 31st, 1610. Kasuban arrived in London on the 30th. Okay? So actually, let's just back this up. So on the 30th,
How do you spell Casaubon? I typed it 100 times and I can't remember.
C-A-S-A-U-B-O-N.
Okay. So, on this day, Casaubon arrives in London. So that means then that they could not have been written before this point. Is everybody following that? Okay, let's go on.
Casaubon arrived in London on October 30th, but his reference to a consultation with one of Boyce's colleagues yesterday rules out that date for the letters. As for their latest possible date, the letters must predate Casaubon's death on the 12th of July, 1614. So we know then that the last they could have written would have been on July 14th, 1614, because this is when Casaubon what? Dies. So they have to fit in this range. So you everybody with me? The King James Bible was not printed until when? 1611, right? So we're talking here the last 2 months now of 1610, or early into 1611, that these letters have to date from because of the clues here from the letters. Let's go back to the notes. As for their latest possible date, the letters must predate Casaubon's death on the 12th of July, 1614. But Casaubon's incidental remarks about his status as a mere visitor in England, his separation from his own library, and his lack of material wealth or other advantages make it likely that the letters fall within the earlier part of this period. Casaubon had been allowed to leave France under the assumption that he would return in a matter of months, and that if he were to stay, he risked losing the stipend that he had been receiving from the French crown. When he left for England, moreover, he did not take his library with him. But within a year of Casaubon's arrival, all of those problems were more or less solved. On the 10th of December 1610, Casaubon received permission from the Queen Regent of France to stay in England and resolved to do so. 5 days later, he received notice that he would be granted two lucrative prebends, and on the 15th of October 1611, he received a substantial part of his library from France. It therefore seems likely that Casaubon wrote his reply to Boyce before any of these things had happened in November or December 1610, but at the very least before the arrival of his books the following year. Okay? So, his books arrive on the October
15th, 1611.
Okay? So somewhere in this time period here, within this year time period, late in 1610 or early in 1611, is when these notes or letters are exchanged between Boyce and who?
Casaubon.
Okay? So there's only a limited window of time that these could have been exchanged within. And it is the same window of time during which Boyce is working at Stationer's Hall and taking notes on the final revision at the general meeting on the King James Bible. You guys following that? Okay? Let's go on. We finished that quote, right? The dating of these letters to late 1610 or early 1611 places them during the final stages of the translation process, thereby making them primary work-in-progress documents. Quote, the letters confirm that serious, if not extension, revision was still being undertaken at a very late stage of the whole process, and that this process of revision extended to the Apocrypha as well as to the canonical books of the Bible. The letters can also help to provide unprecedented insight into the passage of the early stages of the draft, from the early stages of drafting the translation, where the translators were divided into companies, to the finished product of 1611. This is because they happened to cover first Esdras, the apocryphal book that appears to have been drafted by Samuel Ward. See our discussion. So understand what's going on, okay? I'm going to come over here. Hopefully this can still be seen on the... I'll do it over here. All right? So, we know that manuscript Ward B
was the work of Samuel Ward, and that it was early, and that it covers 1 Esdras and Wisdom 3 through 4. Remember this from last week. Okay? In the letters between Boyce and Kasubam that are dated to late 1610, early 1611, Boyce is asking Kasubam about readings found where? 1 Esdras. So Boyce, who was a member of the company, is asking Kasubam very late in the game his opinion about readings that we know Ward worked on very early in the game.
You guys following me? Now again, a lot of people might not have as much interest in this because it's a discussion of apocryphal books. And, excuse me, I admittedly would prefer it much more if this were like Romans or something that they were talking about, but it's not. But that doesn't matter for what we're doing right now. Do you see the level of depth that these guys are having? Let me just be clear. Is Boyce himself a member of the company that worked on the Apocrypha? His fellow company mate, Samuel Ward, did a draft of 1 Esdras. Very early in the game of the process. Now, very late in the game, Boyce is writing letters to Kasubam asking about difficulties they had in 1 Esdras, the very same section that manuscript Ward B deals with. Okay? Let's go back to the notes.
All told, Boyce asked Kasubam about 6 passages from the Apocrypha. Boyce asked Kasubam about 6 passages in total, which he numbered himself. The numbering of the passages follows their order as they are found in all editions of the Bible that feature both of these books covered, beginning in 1 Esdras 3:5 and ending with 2 Esdras 2:23. The first query is written on one side of a single leaf at the top of the page. Boyce promises to write multiple queries, but at the bottom of the page he asks Kasubam to write his opinion about this passage, quote this passage, singular, on the same leaf as the first query. Boyce also expressed his hope that Kasubam will allow him to become one of his, quote, clients, and that if it pleased Kasubam, he will, quote, knock on your door more often and bring you many queries of this kind. Now, that tells me that they are not very far away from each other. Okay? And we know that Kasubam is now in London from other sources, right? Boyce could have been describing a metaphorical visit conducted through the medium of correspondence, but since he reports elsewhere that he met Kasubam several times when they were in London, this is unlikely. Boyce ends the letter by signing his name. Boyce's remaining 5 queries are introduced on a separate leaf. Unlike Boyce's first missive, the second one introduces the remaining problems immediately without any preamble and ends without any validation other than Boyce's initials, as though Kasubam would have known the full name of the sender already. For reasons that will soon become clear, this is probably because the second letter was sent to Kasubam on the same day as the first. So what are we learning here now? Is Boyce sending two, does he send 2 queries to Kasubam? Does he talk as though they are going to, that if Kasubam's okay with it, Boyce would like to come knock on his door to discuss other things? We know from other things that Boyce wrote that he had many multiple meetings with Kasubam while the two of them were both in London at the same time, right? No doubt, in my mind, are they talking about other things related to the translation that aren't necessarily recorded in the written correspondence? It would seem to be a reasonable inference. Excuse me. Kasubam's reply to all 6 queries alludes to the existence of 2 separate letters and gives no indication that Kasubam had received any communication from Boyce other than what is found in this manuscript. It occupies 2 sides of a single leaf and addresses Boyce's queries in the same order as Boyce numbers them. Kasubam begins by explaining that he quote, would be, would have replied to Boyce, to Boyce's quote earlier letter if there had been somebody about his disposal who could serve as a courier for his response. Kasuban's next sentence also reads like an answer to Boyce's suggestion that they meet in person. Quote, indeed, I was and still am minded to visit your residence to hear you talk about matters like these. So, I mean, are they talking here amongst themselves like they're going to get together, you know, have a cup of tea and talk about what's going on? All right. The wording and format of Boyce's two letters and the aggregation of their content into a simple reply by Kasuban suggests that Boyce's letters were written within a short time of each other and in some haste. Boyce clearly hoped to receive a rapid reply to the first problem in particular, requesting an answer, quote, in a few words to the first query alone on the sheet on which it was written. Kasuban's explanation for his failure to respond to the earlier letter indicates that he was aware of the need for a swift response. This is confirmed by a crucial detail that conclusively demonstrates the speed at which Boyce's questions were posed to Kasuban's and Kasuban's answers delivered. The same detail also reveals that other queries, this is important, that other queries relating to the translation of the Apocrypha were coming thick and fast to Kasuban's door, and not all of them from Boyce. So now do we have other translators who are writing Kasuban stuff wanting to know his opinion, particularly on matters related to the Apocrypha? When Boyce introduced the first query about the meaning of a term that occurs in 1 Esdras 9:48 and 45, he comments, quote, I hear that one of my colleagues consulted you about the words yesterday. So what does that tell you? Is Boyce aware that other of his colleagues on this translating committee are there? I think the other guy is Andrew Downs. Okay? The reason I think that is because I know, number one, that Andrew Downs was on the Apocryphal Committee. Second, I know from Boyce's notes that Downs spoke up a lot at the final review at Stationers Hall because Boyce has in his notes AD, standing for Anthony Downs, and recording some of his thoughts or objections or opinions about some of the readings. So now here we know from this correspondence that not only is Boyce asking him questions, but Boyce is aware that others of his colleagues are asking him questions. He being Kasuban. Okay, so let me read that sentence again. When Boyce introduced the fifth query, I think I said the first last time, so I apologize, about the meaning of a term that occurs in 1 Esdras 9:48 and 55, he comments, I hear that one of my colleagues consulted you about the words yesterday. Today, Boyce hopes that Kasuban will not find it tedious to hear his own conjecture about their meaning. Kasuban's affirmation of this fact shows that he was replying to Boyce on the same day as he received Boyce's letter, which must also have been the same day on which the letter was written concerning the problem in 1 Esdras 9. Kasuban says he, quote, can add nothing to what you yourself write and what the outstandingly learned man outlined to me in conversation yesterday. Boyce's letter and Kasuban's reply were therefore all written on the same day, that is, on the day after Kasuban had been consulted about one of the passages in question by one of Boyce's unnamed colleagues. So this shows a level of scrutiny here going on, still very late in the game here. We're talking about late 1610, early 1611, and are they concerned enough to get it right that they're writing to this French scholar who has only recently come to reside or stay in London? You guys following all this? Hope so. Dr. Hardy believes that Boyce's colleague with whom Kasuban had been conversing was none other than Andrew Downs. Downs, like Boyce, had served on the second Cambridge company that translated the Apocrypha, I already said that. Therefore, it would make sense that Boyce and Downs would both be asking Casaubon about, should say, passages from the Apocrypha. Quote, Andrew Downs is a strong candidate, being the only translator other than Boyce who is known to have been involved in both in drafting the Apocrypha and in revising other parts of the translation. Downs, moreover, can be shown to have discussed the Apocrypha with Casaubon soon after the latter's arrival in London, surely with the final revision of the Bible in mind. Finally, Downs and Casaubon had been corresponding with each other ever since Casaubon left Geneva in 1596, and they would continue to do so while Casaubon was in England. Ultimately, however, the lack of definitive evidence means that it is safer to continue referring to Boyce's, quote, anonymous colleague rather than any specific translator. Okay, I agree. Downs' name is not explicitly stated, but I think it is a way more than educated guess that the other guy who's writing him and conversing with him and visiting with him is Downs. We know Downs was on the second Cambridge company that did the Apocrypha, and we know that he and Boyce were both in London at the same time Casaubon was at Stationer's Hall working on the final revision. So, I think it was Downs. It seems to me to be way more than a reasonable, educated guess that it was Downs. Which, again, is interesting. Because Downs and Boyce were on that company. Samuel Ward worked on the first draft. And here they are at the very end of the process wanting to talk to this other French scholar to make sure they're getting it right. All right? Now, that tells me that something I said a few weeks back was not correct. What I said a few weeks back was that the apocryphal section of the King James Bible was largely viewed as the weakest part, and that not a lot of time and attention went into doing that. And the reason I said that was because of stuff I'd read in books. Now the evidence suggests that that's not true. Did they put just as much time and attention into getting this right as they did getting any of the other stuff right in the canonical Old Testament or the canonical New Testament? Okay? Any questions about any of this? Yeah?
Forgive me for my ignorance, but Apocrypha is just the books that didn't make it into the Bible but were considered at the time?
So, the Catholics view the Apocryphal as canonical scripture. The Protestants do not. The Protestants, starting with the, I think it was Coverdale's Bible, they took the Apocrypha. If you look at a Catholic Bible, all the Apocryphal books are put mixed into the Old Testament like they're part of the canon, like they're scripture. What happened with the Apocryphal books in Protestant Bibles is they were taken out of the Old Testament and they were given their own section between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, and they were marked Apocryphal. Okay? So, they still viewed them as having some relevance for history reasons and other things, but the vast majority of them, including King James, did not view them as Scripture. Not having the authority and the authenticity of Scripture, therefore they were sort of segregated between the Testaments, indicating that they are not on the same level of authority or weight as the rest of the Old Testament and the New Testament. But they were in the original project of the King James. They were in the Bishop's Bible, and what these guys are doing is they're revising the Bishop's Bible Apocrypha, and that's what they're discussing. So hopefully I answered your question. Okay. So, judging by the extant evidence, there's little doubt that Casaubon was heavily involved in the revision of the Apocrypha found in the King James Bible. Quote, whatever the identity of Boyce's colleague, it is clear that Boyce's letter to Casaubon formed part of a larger process of revision and consultation. We have seen that Boyce's letter offered to present Casaubon with more queries along similar lines, and Casaubon's reply indicated his desire to hear them. If this happened in person, it would explain why no more letters survive. There can be no doubt that Boyce and Casaubon definitely did meet in person at some point. Years later, Boyce would recall that he saw Casaubon, quote, often when he was in London. These meetings probably pertain to Boyce's work on the King James Bible, for as far as we know, Boyce did not return to London after he finished working on the translation. So when the translation is over, and he's done his job, Boyce leaves London and goes home. And there's no evidence that we know of to suggest that he ever came back to London at some point later, which means he has to be having these conversations with Casaubon between when Casaubon first arrives and when Casaubon dies. It's 1614, and we know that the Bible was finished in 1611, which would have therefore meant Boyce had no more longer any reason to stay where?
In London.
Casaubon's own papers, most of which are now separated from his correspondence and located in the Bodleian Library, provide further evidence that he was fully involved in the revision of the Apocrypha. Most importantly, one of Casaubon's notebooks contains traces of conversation about the Apocrypha with none other than Andrew Downs. These form part of a longer series of notes on Casaubon's studies and his conversation with English acquaintances, which Casaubon began to make on the 4th of December, 1610, soon after his arrival in England. The English figures mentioned also include another translator, John Overall, who hosted Casaubon for nearly a year in his deanery of St. Paul's. Casaubon and Overall's conversations cover technical questions of biblical textual criticism, chronology, and the genealogy of Christ, as well as the theological and ecclesiastical issues that occupied both men. So there's little doubt that he is heavily involved in late-stage revision. His opinion is being consulted. So, any questions before we move on to finish this?
Just real quick. You would assume that there was some prior knowledge of Casaubon by these other individuals and his reputation preceded. Is there any indication or anything that references prior correspondences, you know, not necessarily in person or in London?
Yeah, so it is my understanding. So I could be misunderstanding, so I'm going to qualify what I'm going to say. That in this Greek Old Testament of Boyce, some of Boyce's annotations are referencing an edition edited by Casaubon before he ever came to England. So there is very strong evidence that these guys are aware of this French scholar. He's a Calvinist. He was in Geneva for a long time. They definitely are aware of him, and they're aware of a lot of, which is why when he shows up there, it's like he's now in their backyard and they want to pick his brain about this thing. That's the way I understand it. But there is strong evidence to suggest that they're aware of his writings, they're aware of what he has done before he arrives in England, which is why they are now seeking him out. And I might add, which is why he's invited to a lunch with King James after church. They know who he is. And he is respected for his scholastic achievements and abilities. Okay? So, summative and conclusory statements. Dr. Hardy's essay is both long and thorough. Pages 279 to 285 contain a, quote, sidelight discussion of Boyce's annotated Septuagint in the Bodleian Library. That is what I have included for you in Appendix A on page 10. Okay? Each one of Boyce's queries of Casaubon on the Apocrypha is discussed in detail, along with Casaubon's responses on pages 285 to 308. At the end, Appendix A contains a Latin-English transcript and translation of all three letters. While this information is important and essential, it is complex, tedious, and beyond the scope of this class. I don't think you guys want me to go through every line and discuss every minor detail of everything they wanted, that these guys were talking about. If you want to know, I will gladly borrow you the essay and you can read it yourself. But we would add at least two lessons just on covering every detail these guys are discussing. Okay? So while this information is important and essential, it is complex, tedious, and beyond the scope of the class. Therefore, we will limit our comments to some important summative and conclusory statements from the pen of Dr. Hardy. Quote, here's the first one from early in the essay from page 267. He says, quote, the Boyce-Casaubon correspondence reveals how the translators dealt with a small number of specific problems with a level of forensic detail unmatched by any other document pertaining to the King James Bible. Combined with other evidence, they also show that Casaubon probably assisted in the revision of all of the apocryphal books. Seeing the King James Bible through Casaubon's eyes can thus provide new insight into the mechanics of the translation, but it can also allow us to apprehend the broader scholarly and theological factors that shaped it. So in other words, this is unprecedented insight into what these guys are doing and the level of depth that they're talking about. All right? And then from the end of the essay, nonetheless, Boyce's correspondence with Casaubon give us an unusually deep insight into the confessional and theological exigencies that might have influenced the translator's work. The range and complexity of the intellectual problems faced by the translators of the Apocrypha in particular, the philological and historical resources that might have been used to solve those problems, and finally, the particular sophistication of the discussions that took place when the translation was being revised. According to Hattie Wilson's article dated 4th of May, 2018, for the Church Times titled Frenchmen with Poor English Help Translate the King James Bible, scholar says, Dr. Hardy is, quote, currently working on a book length, writing a book length work of the King James Bible for the Princeton University Press. So, guys, if there is, I mean, this thing is what, 60 pages? What I've decided to do is make you aware of it, make you aware of the discussion. If this discussion between Boyce and Casaubon had been about Romans 5, we'd be looking at it. But it's about obscure stuff from the Apocrypha that most of you probably have never heard about and are never going to care about another day in your life. Okay? However, I included a lesson here in this on 165. You need to be aware of the existence of this material and the level of depth and insight that it demonstrates that they are using as part of their process. Okay? So, let's look at the conclusion. And this is where I probably want to go back to the notes and bring them up. So we're on page 7, right? Okay. So bottom of page 7, conclusion. Please recall that before the week of January 10, 2022, I was unaware of Ward's draft of 1st Esdras and Wisdom 3 and 4, manuscript Ward B, at Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, and the Boyce Casaubon correspondence, manuscript Burney 363, in the British Library. Both resources need to be added to our list of primary work in progress documents and placed appropriately in our working timeline. So go to page 8. Please consider the following updated timeline. All right? So, stage 1. Stage 1, we noted, is 1604 to 1608. All right? The six companies produced their draft translations. Underneath this, we have three documents. We have manuscript Ward B, Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, the first draft work of Samuel Ward on 1st Esdras and Wisdom 3 through 4. We have manuscript 98 at Lambeth Palace Library. Represents stage 1 work of the Second Westminster Company on the New Testament Epistles. That period needs to be brought to the left. That's way off to the side. I'm not sure why. Bodd 1602, the Bodleian Library at Oxford. The annotated 1602 Bishop's Bible with the handwritten annotations of the translators. It bridges the gap between manuscript 98 and what was reviewed at the general meetings. Then we have stage 2. The general meeting or meetings review the company drafts and establish the printed text. From this stage of the process, we have the notes of John Boyce. And we now know that There's two different copies. There's one in Corpus Christi College, Oxford, which is the Fulman manuscript, and there's a second copy at the British Museum, manuscript Harl 750. They contain Boyce's notes on the discussion of the general meaning on Romans through Revelation. And then we have also manuscript Burney 363, which we talked about in this lesson, which is the Boyce Casaubon correspondence from late 1610 and or early 1611. And then finally, we have stage three of the process, which is overseen by the two men, Thomas Bilson and Miles Smith, which work with the King's printer, Robert Barker, to see the text through to the press. And then to testify to that, we have the two different 1611 printings of the King James Bible. Now, I don't know if you guys saw this, but even though I was not making a midweek video, because I couldn't talk, my inability to talk did not prevent me from accessing a database called Early English Books Online, where just this week I pulled off a 1611, a 1612, a 1613, a 1614, a 1617, a 1628, a 1629, a 1638, a 1762, and an original 1769 Oxford Blaney printing off of the database that I now have saved on my computer. So it was a productive week, even though I wasn't making any other videos. Okay, now let's finish this up, though, for the sake of time. Completeness dictates that we also note the following, yet understudied / unclassified works that could one day need to be added to our list of primary work in progress documents pending further study. This would include the Greek Old Testament at the Bodleian Library with copious marginal notes by John Boyce. We don't know if those notes were made before, during, or after the translation. We don't know. Some probably before, some probably during, some probably after. It's just hard to know for sure. And then the Isaac Casaubon's notebooks, also at the British Library, recording conversations he had with another translator, Andrew Downs. Those are also, as of this time, not studied to the level they need to be to know if there's anything in there that gives us insight into the process used by the King James translators. Lastly, Facebook friend and fellow researcher Christopher Yetzer furnished me with the following horizontal timeline for your consideration. Please note that Brother Yetzer's timeline divides the Bod 1602 Old Testament and New Testament into two different sections on the timeline. This is illustrative of a technical point regarding the document that we have not yet discussed. Okay? So here is the document the image that he sent me. So he's broke it down slightly differently than I have.